Hey, and welcome to the Humanity Church Podcast. So excited that you're here. We hope that you enjoy this week's talk and it really connects to your life in a meaningful way. If you're live in the Pomona area, we would love to have you at one of our gatherings at 10 a.m. or at one of our Humanity groups that meet all throughout the week, all over the city. If you want more information about our community, you can go to www.humanitychurch.com or download our app on your phone on Apple or Android. If you like what you're hearing here and want to continue to support the ongoing work at Humanity, you can text the word Humanity Church, one word, to 77977 and give back financially in just about 10 seconds. Hey, and here's this week's talk that was given live at our Sunday gathering at Humanity Church.
We've been in this conversation called Not My God, where we've been taking a look at these images of God that we have taken on, that we've adapted, that we've engaging these images that have been handed down to us. And we want to really look at who is this God that we pray to, that we follow, that we engage with, and is it an actual representation of who he is? Because for so many of us, we have been handed down images of God, and we just accept them as true. For many of us, we see things like God being this angry police officer, like we talked about on the first week, that he's just about us following rules and making sure we're in compliance and making sure we get it right. For others of us, as Marla talked about last week, and she gave an amazing talk, by the way, that God is this grand old white man in the sky who's distant and irrelevant and disconnected and kind of like, what's that Twitter thing again? And he has really nothing to do with where we are today. And the thing is that so many of these images are actually cultural. They have really nothing to do with what the scriptures say of who God is, but they're all about who we have created them to be as a culture. The culture makes up all kinds of things, and then we just accept them as true. In fact, that's what culture is. Culture is just a set of rules that everyone decides, hey, this is what is acceptable, this is what is normal, and then everyone goes along with that, and that's what creates culture. And so we have all kinds of things that our culture creates other than the image of God. Like at some point, our culture just decided that in order to get married, you have to have a diamond ring. Well, like as if that was written anywhere, right? You go to other cultures and there's no such thing as needing to spend $2,000 on a ring in order to get married to someone. It's literally like, hey, you want to get married? Sure, let's go talk to your dad. Great, we're married, right? But in our culture, someone decided, usually a diamond company along the way, that we needed to spend lots of money on diamonds and that was what was going to get us married, or that we need to dress up somehow to come to church, as if I showed up in a three-piece suit, God's like, whoa, lots more respect for you, right? We just have adapted all of these cultural conversations. I mean, one of the ones that seems the most silly to me that we've adapted is that cleanliness is next to godliness. Have you heard that before? I mean, who came up with that? Jesus was a carpenter. I mean, talk about a dirty guy. The guy probably physically smelled. I mean, can you imagine coming out of a workshop, not having a shower, and just being like, hey, here I am. But somehow we, as a culture, have created cleanliness with godliness, and that if you have a clean house, then somehow you're more godly. I don't know where we get these images from, but they've been decided that this is true, and everyone goes along with it. So why are we actually having these conversations? What's the importance of combating some of these images of God that have been handed down to us? Because so often we get an image of God that actually doesn't fit him, that actually doesn't serve well in connecting to who he is. And we might not be able to push past that, or we might be able to push past that. The problem is these images get handed down to others that just assume that they are true, and that it impedes them from actually connecting to the authentic God that is with them. I remember a few years ago, I was in a training coaching a group of people that I was with, and we entered in this time of prayer where we were doing some inner healing, where we were working through some of the hurts and pains of this young man's life. And oftentimes what we'll do is have people recall a memory from their past and get connected with that and invite God to step into that moment, have them in their mind look around and find Jesus in that scene and ask them, what is he doing? And so we were talking about this traumatic moment that had taken place in his life, and I asked him to recall all the memories and all the events, and he was doing that, and I said, where's Jesus in this picture? Now, 9 times out of 10, people are like, oh, he's in the corner, he's in the roof, he's sitting right there. This guy said, I can't see Jesus, can't see him, which is a little red flag for me. So I said, all right, let's keep going. And I said, tell me what you do see. And he said, there's a little kitty cat on my lap and it feels like God. I was like, okay, this is a little untraditional, but I'll go with it, right? So I said, great. So what does the kitty cat tell you? And I'm like, all right, Lord, you're gonna have to show up in this because this is way uncharted territory for me. And he starts spouting out these most profound truths about his life. He says, man, this little kitty cat is telling me that I am loved and that I am cherished and that all these awful things that happened to me were not my fault and that God was actually there in them and that he was looking over me and that he was protecting me and he was caring for me and he was with me in that. And he said, and I said, what are you feeling right now? And he said, I just feel so free. I feel like God is present with me here in this moment, in this space. And afterwards, we were debriefing. And I said, why do you think God showed up like a cat? Because it doesn't make sense to me. And it was interesting because he said, you know, I've always heard that God is this roaring lion. And I've always heard that God is this powerful, like majestic beast that can overtake things. He said, but I think that if God showed up to me as a lion, I wouldn't be ready for that. So God showed up to me as a kitten. And I'm ready now for the lion. And I realized in that moment that God is crazy enough to show up like a kitten when he's also a lion. That he will show up in the middle of any circumstance for whatever we need, how we need it in the moment to get whatever point across. And you see this all throughout the scriptures. God showed up as fire. He talked through donkeys. He showed up in all kinds of crazy situations. And he was basically like, whatever I need to do to get across to you who I am willing to do that. See, we are often limiting God when we hold on to an image that is absolute about who he is, not his character or what he has said to be true of himself, but how he should show up. See, there's nothing wrong with seeing God as big as long as he can also show up small. And there's nothing wrong with believing that Jesus is your homeboy as long as he can also show up as Lord. And so there's both needed in this. And this week we're going to look at an image that is pretty common, and it's an image of God that oftentimes comes around at Christmas time. By the way, Christmas is 14 weeks away, just in case you were wondering. How many of you are ready for Christmas already? We've decided in the neighbor home, Christmas starts like October 31st for us because we need a break. So, and here's the image that oftentimes shows up at Christmas, but then becomes pervasive. And that is that God is meek and mild. We show up often. This is how God shows up. I mean, I actually think we've adapted this image because there's not a lot of other words that rhyme with child, right? Meet child, you know, like there's silent night, holy night, all is calm, around yon virgin mother and child, holy infant, so tender and mild, right? It would be awkward if you're like, holy infant, so tender and wild. That would be bizarre. I think that it's because there's just not a lot of words that rhyme with child. So mild obviously works in the middle of this. But the thing is that this image of God as meek and mild doesn't end with his birth. It actually becomes the pervasive image of how we view who Jesus is. In fact, we oftentimes have this painted image of God. In fact, just look at this image of God right here. I mean, this is oftentimes the image of God that we have. And Marla talked about the grand old white man. But this looks like a guy in a like in a senior center doing finger paints, right? He's doing like marionettes or something. This is a guy who's very chill, right? And losing his mind a little bit. Or we have this image of Jesus, which of course, you can go to the next, this image of Jesus, which of course he's white, first off, and not a problem with that. But here Jesus looks like he's like a combination of a veterinarian that just got out of a day spa, right? Or smoked a lot of weed, right? I don't know, one or the other. But it's this very meek, mild, gentle, like, let me hold a lamb out here, the hills are alive with Jesus in the middle of this. But these are the images that we have, and they're pervasive. Look, there's nothing wrong with this. Don't worry if you have this picture hanging in your house. Don't go take it down. But this is the problem, is that we have this pervasive images of God as if he's just like in a trance walking among community and among humanity and spouting off proverbs every now and then. And look, I think it's actually a great image of to have of Jesus as a child of a good shepherd. I think that's a comforting image as a child to see Jesus as the guy who holds lambs and is in the hills. The problem is that as we grow up and we have more complex emotions, and we engage with more complex circumstances, we actually outgrow the God who sits on a hill with the sheep. We actually need a God who does more than finger paints and plays marionettes, right? We actually need a God who is not just meek and mild in the middle of this. And see, as we grow up and as we get into more complex situations and more complex emotions, we actually start asking ourselves, can God actually handle these? Is God actually up for being the God that I need in the middle of this situation? Now, meek is actually a very powerful attribute. In fact, it's one of the Beatitudes that Jesus talked about. Blessed are the meek. Meek is power harnessed for something beautiful. But the phrase meek and mild is actually different. When you look up that phrase culturally, how it's oftentimes used is spineless or spiritless or compliant. When you talk about someone who's, they're just meek and mild. What you're really saying is, look, they're spineless. They really are spiritless. They don't have a lot of get up and go to them. And they're pretty compliant with whatever's put in front of them. And this is an image where God is more nice than anything. And this becomes incredibly problematic, this phrase, meek and mild, because there is a whole list of things that a nice, meek, and mild God would never do. For example, a meek and mild God would never get angry. A meek and mild God would never show his passion. He would actually never offend. He would never use his power. And what he cares most about is making us comfortable. And this image of God as meek and mild is an interesting one because almost every single other image that we're going to talk about is, for the most part, absolutely not true of who God is. But this one, sometimes God is meek and mild. We actually need a God who controls his power and who says that I am slow to wrath and slow to anger. We need a God at times who says, I want to lead you beside still waters. There are times in life where we need a God who is meek and mild, but he is way, way more than that. See, when you look at the life of Jesus and you compare it to the stoned veterinarian day spa guy, it's in contrast to how he often showed up in life. I mean, when you look at his life, he all but cussed out religious leaders when he was connected with them. He walked through murderous crowds like without a fear in his eye. He spoke to complacency and to exploitation at its very core. He flipped over tables in his father's house. He commanded wind and waves to stop in an instant, and they stopped. He was actually considered a threat to society. He told people, sell everything and follow me. Sell everything and follow me. He was such a threat to society that eventually he was crucified for how he engaged in the world around him. This is not a meek and mild God in any way. This is not a God who sits back and is more concerned about being nice. And we have created an image of God as meek and mild that is both uninspired and uninspiring. That he's not actually exciting to follow. Who wants to follow a God that is impotent and powerless and complacent? It's not an exciting call of our lives to follow this type of a God. I love this moment where Jesus is having a conversation with the guy who eventually he's going to bet everything on, Peter. Eventually, he's going to say, hey, you're the rock on which I'm building this whole movement on, and you're the guy. So he was an important dude to Jesus, Peter. And he's having this conversation where he's telling his disciples about the plan to save humanity. And he says, look, this is what's going to happen. I'm going to be crucified, and I'm going to be raised up. But this is what's going to have to happen in order for me to move forward and for this to happen. And in Matthew 16, starting in verse 21, it says this. From that time on, Jesus began to explain to his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things at the hand of the elders, the chief priests, and the teachers of the law, and that he must be killed and on the third day be raised to life. Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. Never, Lord, he said. This shall never, ever happen to you. Jesus turned to Peter and said, get behind me, Satan. You are a stumbling block to me. You do not have in mind the concerns of God, but merely human concerns. Then Jesus said to his disciples, whoever wants to be my disciples must deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. But whoever wants to save their life will lose it, but whoever loses their life will find it. What good is it for someone to gain the whole world yet forfeit their soul? Or what can anyone gain in exchange for their soul? For the Son of Man is going to come in his Father's glory with his angels, and then he will reward each person according to what they have done. Truly I tell you, Some who are standing here will not taste death before they see the Son of Man coming into his kingdom. Now, this is clearly one of Jesus' more intense moments with Peter. He had a lot of intense moments with Peter, but this is clearly one of his more intense ones. He literally turns to his closest friend on the planet and says to him, "You are Satan, for interfering with my plans in the middle of this." Now, this is not the most meek and mild statement to share with your friend, right? I mean, in terms of meek and mild, this does not represent that clearly to anyone. I have a lot of family who are in Texas. I was in Houston last week doing a training. And let me tell you, Houstons have a way of doing like a nice, Texans have this nice way of doing like a backhanded, they're like backhanded thing, but with sugar, and it usually is like, "Well, bless your little heart," right? This isn't even like attempting to sugar on it, right? This isn't like, "Oh, Peter, bless your heart," right? This is like a, "You are Satan," right? And this is how he interacts with him in the middle of this. This is the God that is known for love. This is the God who actually says, "I am love," who calls his closest friend Satan. How do these things jive with one another in the middle of this? See, I think part of the breakdown between this image of meek and mild Jesus and Jesus that called his friend Satan is that part of the breakdown is that we have a very skewed view of what love actually means. See, because I think for so many of us, love means being nice at all costs. Love actually means I need to be nice at all costs, which nice is a word that has been banished from the neighbor household, and I'll tell you why in just a little bit. And really, what we believe at our core at times is that love is all about making people feel good around us. And as long as people feel good, then love is happening. So of course, God should be nice above anything else. The word nice is such an interesting word because it comes from the same root word that we get the word ignorant from, or the word ignore. And really, the word nice, when we're saying, "I'm just being nice, I want to be nice to them," what we're actually saying is, "I am going to ignore all of the areas in their life that are leading them towards darkness, and I am going to ignore all the things in their life that will eventually lead them to breakdown, and I am going to ignore all the things in their marriage that are eventually going to lead to divorce, and I'm going to ignore all of the choices that they are making that will eventually lead them down a path that will end up in destruction so that I can make sure that they're comfortable." And at the end of the day, when we say, "I would rather be nice than anything else," what we're actually saying is, "I would ignore everything else. And what matters most to me is complacency and maintaining comfort." And so oftentimes, we make Jesus into this same image of the nice God. See, because here's the thing. At the end of the day, love always looks like sacrifice. You'll hear me say that 1,000 times. And what Jesus constantly demonstrated was his willingness to sacrifice his own ego, was to sacrifice his need to be right, his need to look good. He actually was not worried if you liked him or if what he said was culturally acceptable. He talked to women as a man, which was something unheard of because women were property. And so every time in the scriptures where Jesus talked to a woman, it would have been like mind-boggling for people to understand that. Not only did he talk to women, he talked to minorities. And that was completely unheard of as a Jew, that he would go up and he would have deep, intimate conversations with them and call them into relationship with him. He spoke the truth to everyone, and he was more concerned about the other person over there. He was more concerned about them finding life, about them finding hope, about them stepping up their game into the life that he knew that they were called for and that they needed this moment or else they were going to get away. See, Jesus was willing to offend the mind to reveal the heart. Because he cared enough about the other person over there, and he was so, so, so filled with passion about that he pursued it at all costs. Proverbs 27, 5-6 says, "Better is an open rebuke than hidden love. Wounds from a friend can be trusted, but an enemy multiplies kisses." Have you ever had someone love you in a way that didn't feel nice in the moment? I mean, that you're just like, I know you love me, and I know that you are only doing this out of love because you are sacrificing a lot to say this, to do this, to interrupt this thing, and it does not feel good in the moment, but you got that they're loving you. You got that they actually cared for you enough to have the conversation. See, I am rebuked so often and corrected so often that I actually am concerned when I'm not rebuked. I actually get a little nervous when I go like a month without someone saying, hey, here's an area that you missed it. I actually get nervous with that because I actually live from the assumption that I am missing it in areas and that I need someone else to show me where I am missing it. So there's a level of gratitude when people come to me and say, hey, Nathan, that was arrogant over there. You need to knock it off. Hey, Nathan, that was entitled. You need to knock that off. I'm so grateful when people that are close to me that I get love me come to me and say, hey, I'm willing to risk the relationship to actually tell you what is over there. And I can tell you, I have men and women in my life that I have both invited and that they have asked permission to speak into my life and say, hey, can I share this? And I've given them permission to do that. And I am so grateful when they actually do this. Here's the thing. If you haven't had some type of a rebuke from a friend lately, you might want to check in with your friends. Because either you've achieved a level of perfection that is amazing, right? Or people are being dishonest with you about what's not working. See, God often comes to us with authentic love and passion. And he shares to us with us exactly what we need to hear, exactly what's gonna bring us to life, exactly what's gonna move us towards hope. And it is rarely meek and mild. He is much more concerned with the truth that is going to set us free than our comfort. He is much more concerned with stepping us into that. Now, there is always grace with truth, with Jesus. Grace says, look, I still love you. I want to be in life with you 100%. I know that you've done all kinds of crazy things. I've seen them, and I am still madly in love with you. That's what grace says. But here's the thing. Grace doesn't take away the sting of truth, does it? I mean, just because someone says, look, I'm with you. You can count on me. I'm going to be in this with you. I will not go anywhere. I love you. You can literally crucify me, and I will stay right there. And here's the truth of what's going on that I must address out of love because you will be destroyed if I don't step into this. And Jesus, with Jesus, it is always love. It is always kind, but it is often anything but spineless and spiritless because he is jealous for us. I love that definition, that metaphor, that characteristic of God, that he is jealous, that he has so much passion for us. See, I think in our culture, we are so obsessed at times with being nice and meek and mild and just pretending that everything is okay and that everything's working out and that I'm fine and you're fine and the world is fine until we're not. And then we move instantly from meek and mild and nice to anger and spite. It's as if there's only two options in this world. That we're either living in a space of meek and mild and nice, or we shift the pendulum to anger and spite and disrespect and meanness. And you see this everywhere in culture right now. It is absolutely insane that people who are friends, who are family, all of a sudden now feel that it is okay to move from, hey, I love you, we're connected, we're friends, to anger and spite in how we communicate with one another over silly beliefs like politics that in 10 years from now, we will literally have no clue what took place. And this is how we find ourselves at times, that when we speak to with one another, that we're either withholding everything or we explode out of anger and spite and resentment. See, the opposite of meek and mild is not anger and spite. The opposite of meek and mild is passionate and powerful. And that is what Jesus was. Jesus was fully passionate and powerful, but he was always kind. And kindness is distinct from niceness. Kindness says, hey, I am going to have the authentic, passionate, powerful relationship that I long for with you, and I choose to be kind in this. See, what Jesus did was he always harnessed his passion. He always harnessed his power. He harnessed everything that was in them, all of the power and the energy that he had for people, and he always used it for people, never against people. He always took all of the joy and the hope and the beauty that was inside of him and all of the frustration about where we were missing it, and he never used it as a weapon to attack someone. He always used it as a gift to move people forward. He harnessed it for us, for a new future, for a connection, for transformation, for an elevation of our lives up to God. And even with Peter, Jesus recognized that this was a dude filled with passion and power. I mean, Peter was like a wild man, right? And what Jesus understood was that if Peter did not get a hold of his passion and power and harness it for good, he was going to do a lot of evil with it. He realized that if Peter did not get a hold of his gifting of passion and power, he would move towards anger and spite. And let me just tell you, Peter was thrown to that over and over and over again. I mean, if you just look at Luke chapter 22, starting in verse 47. In Luke chapter 22, starting in verse 47, Jesus is out praying on the night before he was about to be crucified with all of his disciples. Judas comes with a team of Roman guards and basically is leading them there to capture Jesus. And this is what transpired. While he was still speaking, a crowd came up, and the man who was called Judas, one of the 12, was leading them. He approached Jesus to kiss him, but Jesus said, "Judas, you are betraying the Son of Man with a kiss?" When Jesus' followers saw what was going on and happening, they said, "Lord, should we strike with our swords?" Now, mind you, Luke's being nice here, right? All the other gospels are like, it was Peter, right? Luke's like, One of the disciples, right? And one of them, Peter, struck the servant of the high priest, cutting off his right ear. But Jesus answered, "No more of this." And he touched the man's ear and healed him. See, this is such a powerful moment with Jesus and Peter again. Here, Peter is taking all of his passion, all of his power, and he is responding with anger and spite to the powers in front of him. He's taking this huge gift that is inside of him, and he's saying, "I am going to harness this for anger and spite." And he is thrown to this like so many of us are. And it seems to be the favorite cultural conversation to swing back and forth between I'm shutting up and I'm never going to get on Facebook again to I'm going to attack everyone that I know. And we just swing back and forth between the two. Jesus then turns around and actually heals the guard. See, this is the passion and power of Jesus right here. This is his passion and power bridled and used for good, for kindness. See, we confuse Jesus' kindness with meekness and mildness. But see, in our culture, there isn't a space for kindness to sit right next to power and passion. There's not a space for them to be informed by one another. It's either one or the other. But see, his forgiveness was just as powerful as his rebuke here in this moment. Both were kind. See, Jesus invites us to own the fullness of passion and power of the life that he has given us, but only informed by kindness. That it must always, always be informed by kindness, because when passion and power is informed by kindness, and when kindness informs our passion and power, it changes the world. It transforms everything. When someone who is passionate and also says, "I refuse to fight you. I choose to stand with you. I choose to stand for you. I don't care if you're literally the dude cutting off my ear, sending me off to my death. I choose kindness with my passion and power." It changes everything. I wonder what would take place right now if we just all decided, "I'm going to own fully my passion and power, and I am going to have it informed by kindness." The world would look so dramatically different in this. If you hadn't noticed, we are in a cultural conversation about power right now. There is a huge conversation about power that's taking place in our lives right now. And it stems from a correction of historical abuses of power. And rightfully so, We're in the middle of a cultural revolution that is taking place saying, look, we must examine where power has been misused and is being misused. So now we're looking to actually correct the injustice that has taken place and that has been alive and well, except for so many who are entering into this conversation, we are doing exactly what Peter is doing. We are thrown to anger and spite. We are thrown into that space. And here's the thing, anger and spite are always fueled by bitterness, by resentment for what has been or hasn't been in our past. And there's no room for kindness. There's no room to actually say, hey, let's be in this together. I am now fighting against you for something rather than fighting together for something. And the problem with this is that it always throws us into a zero-sum game, which means that someone has to lose in order for someone to win. Something has to be taken from someone in order for someone else to be given something. There's only so much. And so I have to take or I have to give up to give to them. So you have to lose an ear for my freedom. I get to cut off part of you so that I can live fully in the life that I have called myself into and that God has called me into. And there is no room for abundance. There's no room for us all to be elevated in this conversation. Let's take this down to a more personal level. There are people in our lives that have misused their passion and power. I know that as soon as I say that, you can probably think of a number of lives that have misused their passion and their power in your life. That they took their power and their passion and they turned to anger and spite and resentment and they turned it into hate or they turned it into abuse and you were the recipient of that. For so many of us who have been on the receiving end of passion and power misused, the internal conversation, the spiritual conversation that we now live in is power equals bad because they abused it. That passion equals pain because they abused it. And so we find ourselves refusing to trust any type of power, even the power that God is wanting to release in me, let alone a God who is powerful, let alone a God who is passionate. So now, I get to use the little power that I do have that I'm holding on to cut off the ears of other people. It shouldn't be a surprise that we can't hear each other anymore. And so all we are left with is a society that is deaf to one another, trying to get and preserve the little that we have. And let me tell you, that game kills the passion and the power that Jesus is wanting to well up in you, that he is wanting to infuse in your life. And it is a cycle that will eventually become deadly when we give into it. See, to me, it's always so interesting that Jesus, filled with passion and power, told Peter he was Satan and then healed the man that was going to illegitimately execute him. See, because the difference between Jesus and us is that he passionately cared about reaching the heart and soul of both the oppressed and the oppressor. He was just like, hey, you out there. Yeah, you can clap for that. Because here's the fact, is that we are all oppressed and oppressors. If we were to look at our lives, we can see places where people have misused their power with us, and we can see places where we have misused our power with one another. And Peter certainly did. And yet he was the one that Jesus said, I'm going to build my church on this. See, I find it often that people often look to Jesus flipping over tables to justify their misuse of passion and power. It's like the go-to story. Well, Jesus flipped over tables, right? See, what we don't actually recognize is that those tables were in his house. Those tables were in his father's house. He didn't go to Rome and flip over their tables. He flipped over the tables in his own home because he said, this is my Father's house. And then we miss that just a few chapters later, the same leaders that he just flipped over the tables in the house, he's having dinner with and having conversations with them. We forget that the same people that executed him hours before, he actually heals them. We forget that he broke bread with tax collectors along with flipping over the tables. And he forever transformed the world because of that. Because he was always informing his passion and his power with kindness and stepping into that fully. See, I think that this is what makes a meek and mild God so appealing. That with a meek and mild God, I'm actually not protected, and I don't have to be called up to a higher standard, and I never have to deal with a God who might do something off the cuff, but at least I'm in control. At least I get to stay keeping things close to my chest, and I don't have to release anything in that. See, I will not let a powerful God into my life because he can never hurt me. I will refuse to follow a passionate God because there will never be any pain involved with that. He will never ask me to step up into a higher life. He will never call me to sell everything and give my life away. He will never ask me to lose my life to gain it. And so I don't have to deal with that type of God. He is never, ever, ever going to interrupt the comfortable life that I have found myself in. With a meek and mild God, there are no consequences, so I get to do what I want. And so it makes sense why this image of God would be so appealing, because he is most concerned about my comfort and my feelings. The problem is that when we remain in control without consequence and without any accounting for my actions, when we need power, we are left wishing that we actually had a powerful God. When we are actually in need of a God to show up and change everything, we're left wondering, where is the God of power in my life? See, when moments are dark, we do not need a meek and mild God. Right now, we do not need a meek and mild God who is sitting in the wings going, oh, I don't know what's happening over here. We don't need that right now. See, you can have a meek and mild, you cannot have a meek and mild God when it is convenient and then expect him to destroy your enemies when it's inconvenient. You just can't. And this is what we find ourselves in. You know, people are often in a conversation with me about why people are leaving the church universally. We're growing here at Humanity Church, which is nice, but people are always like, why are people leaving the church? And people have all kinds of answers about why the church universally is in decline. And I actually don't think it's because there are theological differences on hot topics. The thing that I've actually found is I can have a meaningful, intimate conversation with someone, completely disagree, and walk away being brothers and sisters still. And saying, hey, we're in this. I'm with you. I'm for you. Yes. That's actually possible. I know it's hard to believe. It might be because people feel like God's an old white man in the sky and he's irrelevant to our lives today. I don't really think that's the case. See, I actually think that people are leaving the movement of Jesus because we have lost our roots of being a wild people and we have settled for mild. That we have lost our roots of being wild men and women in the middle of this. No one dreams of living a life that is comfortable and unnoticed and uninspired. There is something inside of us that longs for more, that longs for passion, that longs for power to change the world around us. And an untamed and passionate God, that's who I know God to be. Let me tell you, that is an attractive invitation to step into a life that is filled with passion and purpose and kindness and transformation and that changes the world around us. That is an invitation worth following. See, and to go back to Matthew 16, after he calls Peter Satan, he gives probably some of his most profound words about our lives and the value of them. And he says, then Jesus said to his disciples, whoever wants to be my disciple must deny themselves and take up their cross and follow me. For whoever wants to save their life will lose it, but whoever loses their life for me will find it. What good will it be for someone to gain the whole world yet forfeit their soul? Or what can anyone give in exchange for their soul? For the Son of Man is going to come in his Father's glory with his angels, and then he will reward each person according to what they have done. See, this is the powerful, passionate invitation that Jesus calls us into. This is not a meek and mild invitation right here. Anything but that. See, he calls us to deny ourselves and take up the cross and to follow me. What he's actually saying is, hey, come on this adventure. Get off the sofa, get off the ordinary, get off the mundane, and step into this adventure of rediscovering what it actually means to be human, what it actually means to have purpose and power in this life. He says, whoever wants to lose their life will find it. Whoever saves it will lose it. And he's actually saying, come and fully live. You know that voice inside of you that says, I must live bigger. I must have more than this. Not even about money, but about just energy and passion and life. He's saying, come and get out of the dead that you are living in and live fully alive, not just existing through your days, but grabbing hold of them and harnessing them for something bigger than this. What good is it for someone to gain the whole world yet forfeit their soul? Or what can anyone give in exchange for their soul? He says, stop chasing after all the meaninglessness. Stop chasing after the likes and the accolades and the privileges and the things that you want and all of the monetary things and all of the new cars and all of the vacations and all of the futures and all of the perfect families and all the things that you want for. Would you stop looking at all of the junk and come find fulfillment and passion in what's actually going to move you towards life? Set down the mundane, set down the nice, and come find passion and purpose and power that you were actually designed to live in. See, following Jesus is actually crazy. I can just tell you that. When I told my great-grandmother that I was going to be a pastor, she cried and said, please, if there's anything else that you can do. This coming from a pastor's wife. Because she knew that the life I was about to step into was going to be insane. That it was going to be crazy. Paul actually says of us who follow Jesus, he says, we're out of our minds. He said, I actually choose to be out of my minds for the sake of you. Because here's the thing. When you start following Jesus, crazy, passionate, powerful things start happening. Yes. I can't tell you. Marla and I have been in our living room and watched people physically healed in our living room and have had their lives forever changed in an instant. We've watched marriages that are literally about to sign divorce papers step into hope and passion and purpose again and have their family and legacy put back together as a result of Jesus invading them through conversations. We have had nothing and everything all at the same time and have never regretted it for a moment. We have died and we have come back to life. We have tasted the depths of hell, and I can live to tell the story because there is a passionate Savior who saves us over and over and over. Over and over again. See, this is not a meek and mild God. This is a God of passion and power, and he is passionate for you, and he is passionate for humanity. And he is using all of it harnessed for kindness in the world around us. See, the question that you have to answer is, are you willing to let go of your small, insignificant image of who God is, and simultaneously let go of your small, apathetic, insignificant, powerless, passionless version of life, and step in to the fullness of this one glorious life that you have been called to? Because this is the call of Jesus. It is not meek and mild. It is a call to the fullness of life. Let's pray. Jesus, you are wild and you are unexpected and you are so kind. God, forgive us for where we've made love so small and insignificant, where we've made it nice and comfortable. And God, forgive us for where we have only seen the other option of anger and spitefulness. God, teach us to be kind, but teach us to live with passion and purpose and power. God, this moment in history, more than ever, we need people who are filled with passion and power and kindness. It's what's going to change the world. It is not whoever's going to be elected on November 3rd. It is people who are taking up the call to live in the passion and power and kindness. God, that is the answer. It is the answer to the injustice. It is the answer for the immigrant and the citizen. It is the answer for the unborn and for the young woman struggling. God is the answer. It's you in all of your passion and power and glory through us. God, come right now and create an unrest within us. May we no longer settle for the small life, but step into the fullness that you have for us. And this morning, if you're here or you're watching online and you have not yet connected to Jesus, I'm just letting you know, it is not a call on your life when he says, come follow me, to live a small, meaningless, religious, hey, I come and I show up and I sing worship songs and I give some money and I go home. That is not it. It is, I live a life filled with passion and power and purpose, and my life is expanding daily because I am connecting to this God of passion and purpose and kindness. And this is the invitation to you, to come alive, to leave behind all of the sin and the brokenness and all of the past, and to step into the passionate life that he's called you into. And if that's you today, if you're like, I'm ready for that life. I'm so sick of playing small. I am so sick of living this life that is mundane and comfortable, and I'm not even knowing how I'm gonna get through the next thing. This is your moment to connect to the God who is filled with passion and purpose. And so right now, if that's you in this place, I want you to just raise your hand and say, I'm ready to connect to that Jesus. Awesome. If you're at home, I want you to, if you're on our website, I want you to just click that button that says, I'm committing to follow Jesus. If you're on Facebook or YouTube or any other platform, in the comment section, I know this is weird, just say, I'm choosing Jesus right now. And I want you to pray this prayer with me. It's not magic words. It's just you connecting to him and just say, dear Jesus, I give you my mundane, ordinary, broken life. I confess that I am broken, and that I have settled, and I choose you. I make you Lord. I know that you died and you came to life for me out of passion. And so now I give you everything. Come fill me, that I might fully live. And I step into the powerful, passionate life that you have called me into. I thank you. In Jesus' name. In Jesus' name. Amen. Amen.
Hey, thanks for joining us on the Humanity Church podcast. We hope that this was a meaningful experience, and we look forward to connecting again next week for another conversation around what it looks like to live by faith, to be known by love, and to be a voice of hope. Again, for more information about Humanity Church, you can visit us online at humanitychurch.com. And if you want to support the ongoing work here at Humanity Church, including this podcast, you can give online in about 10 seconds by texting the word Humanity Church, one word, to 77977. Thanks, and have an amazing week.